Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week in November, if you can believe it. I blew in here on the wind you've all noticed. We had a bit of frost on Monday morning and have had ample rain and wind. November. Jude Rubin will join me to discuss her community and environmental work. First, let's hear the mystery sound. This creature is so common, you might have come near to stepping on it. And now we'll do some observations for this week. Brought to you with the help of Charlie Fleshman, our inimitable engineer.
Thank you, Mary. How many types of fish in the Salish Sea? Salish Sea, it covers 6,500 square miles, including Puget Sound, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the San Juan Islands, and the Strait of Georgia. A lot of fish observation and counting has finished with a new review published this fall. It puts the region's total number of fish species at 253. That includes 37 species never before documented in this area. The surveyors note that while some are visitors from warmer weather, most are not. The new census, the first in 35 years, is a catalog of all species ever recorded and verified across the Salish Sea. It builds on several previous lists, including one published in 1880 that counted just 90 types of fish. The newly published list is still growing with 5 discovered since publication. Ted Peach, retired from UW, and James Orr of the National Marine Fisheries Service, co-authored it with private funding. Orr estimates the new list captures 90% of all fish in the Salish Sea. It seems like we're pretty close to everything that's out there, he said. The study will culminate in a book with each species illustrated and will join the already completed studies on Salish Sea birds and mammals. All the studies are funded by Sea Doc Society, a private conservation group. Thanks to the Sunday Seattle Times, November 15th.
Thank you, Charlie. And I'd like to add that if any of you want to see one of the exquisite illustrations that they're doing of these fish, check into the Sunday, November 15th Times, where they have a reproduction of the fish which are being done in pencil and watercolor. They're exquisite. Mushroom season is slowing down. I hate to see this. I looked at some chanterelles this morning in the co-op, and the box was pretty low. Sue Chasen of the Olympic Peninsula Mushroom Society reports that recent hunts have been productive. While looking in the hills behind Squim, Port Angeles, and around Forks, members harvested chanterelles in quantities sure to make a mushroom hunter joyful. Her photo showed the largest one I've ever seen, a chanterelle bigger than your two hands held side by side. If you happen to possess an overage of chanterelles, the Olympic Peninsula Mushroom Society suggests a breakfast of scrambled eggs over sautéed chanterelles. It sounds like the frittata from heaven. As the weather cools and moves into frost, the mushroom season stops. Farewell to a great adult treasure hunt for this year and back in the spring to hunt more owls. We are today on Nature Now meeting with Jude Rubin, who has contributed a great deal to the environment and environmental leadership. She was awarded the Eleanor Stops Award this year in 2015 for the things that she has done. And I know she's been doing them for a long time because Jude and I had the pleasure of working together in Seattle in the late 80s and in the 90s on a program called Sustainable Gardening. We wanted people to see examples of how to garden without including nasty pesticides that didn't belong. She was working with Seattle Tilth. I was working with Washington State University Extension, and we had Philip Dickey from Washington Toxics Coalition working with us. It was a great project. It ultimately became called Green Gardening. Now everything is green, but at the time, right?
Right.
There weren't a lot of green things handy. Jude has already also worked with River Network, the Northwest Watershed Institute for Conservation and Restoration in the Tarboo Creek Thabob Bay watershed. She is the founder of Shooting Star, which she will probably say a little more about. Right now, we are going to talk not about Jude's old projects, but some of the new ones that she is coming forward with. All of these names of projects are just words until somebody comes alive with action, and that is Jude's method. So we're going to start by reviewing a bit. The thing that many of you may know the most from Jude's work is the plantathon. I told her that when my cat expired, I got a card that said, from the vet, that said, a tree has been planted in your cat's honor, and my cat would have been pleased.
How did you feel about that, Mary, when you got
the card? I was delighted. I was absolutely delighted. And thinking about it, my mother has a tree in the Big Basin area of California that you could honor a person with a tree. And I've known that for a person, but when it's an animal, it's just as terrific.
There's a backstory there with
Ginny
Johnson.
Okay, well, let's jump in. How did you get started with the idea of developing for Plantathon?
Well, after we worked together, Mary, on pesticide reduction, I shifted gears because I went to Alaska and I had the opportunity to fly over an unbroken forest. And I felt like I could really see the earth breathing. And I had this big shift, and I realized that as wonderful as land cultivation is, I felt that maybe my role would be better as someone who was uncultivating or restoring native landscapes. And I had no experience in that, so I went back to graduate school, did a lot of study and projects all over the place in Washington and Central America, and finally ended up studying the Chimicum Creek and doing some of the early watershed analysis there. Anyway, a big need that we always have in when we're restoring a creek, sort of the final touch and something that helps pull the ecosystem up by its bootstraps, is planting trees. And when we would implement these projects, we never had enough people to plant the trees. So as Peter Bales would say, we would put posters all around town and really advertise, and the same three guys would always show up. At the same time, we had young children. I went to a fundraising meeting at OPEPO, which is the alternative program for grade school children. It's a multi-age program. And they happened to go to a fundraising meeting where they were talking about their upcoming plans. There was this big crisis because, as you recall, in 2004 was when there were major cuts to public school funding. So there were sort of these twin needs. One was in the public schools. This was really a crisis. This was parents no longer having to raise $200 or $300 with a bake sale. They had to raise thousands and thousands of dollars to maintain staff positions and programs. And they were really deeply concerned about this. So I kind of went home that night, and it wasn't an idea that I thought of. It was more one that sort of came through me. And I remember literally sitting up in bed in the middle of the night and thinking, well, if they can sell cookies and they can sell cookie dough and they can sell magazine subscriptions.
And they can wash cars.
And they can wash
still
cars. Right? And all that is great. But why can't we do something that's a little bit more aligned with what they're learning in their science class? You know, why can't they sell the act of planting a tree? So that was kind of a long-winded backstory on
how
that came to be.
It has been serving the community for 10 years. And when we first talked about this, you noted that it's impossible to hand a child a tree and say, go plant that. There needs to be all kinds of preparation.
Yes.
And I thought that was really fascinating, that engineering and perhaps geology and a lot of study of a site has to happen before you set out to put in even one Douglas fir seedling.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, how does that happen?
So the way it works is Northwest Watershed Institute and any other organization that's doing the tree planting, because there are several in this area, not just NWI, we'll do an extensive study of the history of the site. So we were talking about the GLO surveys that used to go out in the early 1800s before there were any European settlers here at all to try to determine what the land was like and what kind of resources there were and was it suitable for agriculture or forestry. So we would go through all of those handwritten reports and the old irrigation maps to determine where the streams used to be. We look at the soils. We look at the kinds of plants that grow there. We look at the geology, the way that water moves through the landscape. Of course, what kind of animals are there. It's a very multifaceted study. And oftentimes, it's not just a matter of planting trees. Oftentimes, you actually have to move the creek itself and reshape it or add wood to it. And there are lots and lots of steps that come before the tree planting.
Okay. One of the things that I'm curious about is in the case of the site that you started with on the Tarbu Creek and in the Daybob Bay watershed, what was the history of what had happened in that place? A lot of logging? Or?
The history was very typical of lowland valleys here. Mm-hmm. So it was very accessible, and so it was cut. It was logged. There was quite a bit of ancient spruce in the Tarbu, which, as you know, grows very wide and not too tall. A lot of that, my understanding, was used for airplanes and for interior in houses at about the turn of the century.
Right. And airplanes were developing, ultimately there was the spruce goose, which
The turn of the last century.
Right. The spruce goose was not made out of concrete. Right. No, we are multi-century people.
Anyway, so. And then a lot of what was going on was cattle farming. And so it was an experiment to really see whether this land was appropriate for cattle ranching. And it was very, very wet, peaty soil. There's not much drainage if you look at it. Chimicum's even flatter than Tarbu. Tarbu's got about a 5-degree grade, and Chimicum's like about 3% grade.
Wow.
Very flat and very, very wet.
Mm-hmm. And so that the hooves and weight of the cattle must have damaged the land to some degree, or just pressed it down, or?
I don't know the answer to that, Mary, but I do know that what they had to do was build a lot of ditches and a lot of drainage in order to keep the cattle out there in the first place. The farmers had to do that. And of course, no one meant any sort of ill intent to the salmon, but the upshot was that the salmon habitat was very simplified. So instead of being a meandering creek with lots of trees in it and lots of rocks and riffles and pools, it became a ditch with a fire hydrant kind of a flow coming
through
it.
Kind of like visualizing Holland with straight areas around fields and things like that. So this is the opposite of what you needed in terms of restoration. You needed to bring it back to the original meander of the stream. And so this can take months to get done.
Oh, years.
Oh,
many
years.
Years.
All right, years.
Decades. Yeah, it's a slow kind of a process. Yeah.
But when you finally get to the point where you go into a classroom to talk to students about this is what you're going to be doing, what do you emphasize with, say, third graders about why are we having this project? I think often people don't tell school children, why are we learning this? But in this case, you can.
So we work with a lot of schools. We've worked with 7 of the schools in Jefferson, which is almost all of them. And so we do work from pre-K all the way to 12th grade. Okay. And then, in fact, some kids come back from college to be crew leaders. So you're right. At different grade levels, we talk about different things with a third grader. We would emphasize, and we wouldn't necessarily put it in these terms, but we would emphasize the relationship between the temperate rainforest and the anadromous salmon. So in other words, what's the relationship between the marine environment and our forests? Why are they so rich? Mm-hmm. The salmon come back and they die here, and their carcasses are spread out, and all the different 113 different species of animals eat them. And so that's where we would go with third graders.
I didn't
know
that were that many animals eating salmon. My
Jeff
goodness.
Cederholm, early 1990s, he did an amazing study.
That is incredible. Right. I suppose that counts worms and up, or subterranean animals of various types. But, oh, my gosh.
Pod,
so when you're talking about this, one of the qualities you have is enthusiasm, and I imagine that transferring that over to the students, they then can say, well, we're going to have this day, we're all going to go out. But you have each student assigned to a particular area. I mean, it's not a matter of let's all just mill about trees into the ground.
Well, there are 5 schools involved, and I would love to mention which they are. There's Swan School, Jefferson Community School, the Ocean Program of the public school, the Port Townsend Public School Program, the Chimicum Pie Program, and the Students for Sustainability from Port Townsend also play a big role. In the past, Sunfield's been involved, as well as Quilcene Schools. Mm-hmm. When we mix them all up out there, they're all together, they're cross-pollinating and having a great time meeting each other, but we divide the site up into 10 zones, and we've kind of prearranged. Well, we do crew leader training as well. We do a day of crew leader training. So for each zone, there's both youth, teen crew leaders and adult crew leaders who know what to do. They basically run the day, and they know what to plant where. They know how to identify the plants. They know what our protocols are. Basically, we download all the information to them, and they specialize on each site, each zone.
So when you're dealing with a site that might have a higher drier area and a low wetter area, which kinds of plants would your students be using in each area?
Well, in the higher, drier areas, they'd be using Doug firs, and they'd be using, some maples, maybe some alders. And then in the lower areas, they'd be using Pacific crab apple is a big one down there, as well as, of course, willow, the wetland trees.
But that in itself is a learning experience for the children. We can't plant this tree over there because it won't work.
And one of the things that I love so much is that they do it year after year. So these kids who've started in second grade and maybe they were kind of running around and, you know, just putting them wherever anyone said to, eventually grow up to be high school crew leaders. Some of them do. And they actually master the material you're talking about.
That's really great.
Right plant, right place.
And there it was it Opal Bednark who came back? She had a quote that I was hoping we could remember to put in. I'm remembering it as, I grew up thinking that planting is just a normal thing that you do in season.
Yes.
And that is not an experience that the average middle school and high schooler would actually be growing up with. So I think that's really a wonderful statement.
That was one of our biggest goals, was just to normalize this as something that we do. It's just
one thing we do is plant some trees.
First you have Christmas, then you have Martin Luther King Day, and then you have Plantathon Day, and then after
traditionally, when it has occurred, it's occurred in February when the rains are still presumably coming when you need them, and the ground is saturated to a degree, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're working in places where you don't have hose access.
Right. No, right? It's all natural irrigation.
Okay. And you said that when you were working on the plantathon, you found yourself with getting a social model for other projects, because several of the things that you have led have been not just your work, but certainly you are a team leader by nature.
Well, no, I'm very, very highly, I'm radically collaborative.
Okay.
And inclusive. So
there'll be a Girl Scout badge for that.
Well, it's funny that you say the Girl Scouts, because when I sat up in bed that night thinking about this idea for the Plantathon, I did think back to my own experience as a Girl Scout. And you're out there selling cookies, and that's great. And they have these prizes that they award to whoever sells the most. So part of the strategy I presented to the parents at OPEPO was that there would be prizes for the people who could plant the most or sell the most cards. And one of the moms took me aside after the very first meeting. It was Anna Frank. Yeah. She sort of set me straight. She said, you know, we're all for one and one for all. If you like planting trees, plant lots of them. And if you like selling cards, sell lots of them. But, you know, and it came to me. I thought, oh, of course, that's much better.
We have stepped into tree world, and we are approaching, unfortunately, the end of our time. And I want to talk with you a little bit about the bag monster and the value of humor, so that people who are recognizing, yes, the environment needs us, but we don't have to necessarily take that as a sad, droopy, everything is so hard, right?
I think every environmental movement needs a monster.
Okay, well, so the bag monster, many of our listeners to Nature Now may have met the bag monster, but I thought you could tell me a little more about this.
Well, he's from the Bronx, and he talks like this, and he's very arrogant. He's made of over 500 plastic bags. And
is he proud of his bags?
Oh, he loves his job, and he's very hurt that poor Townsend banned him, you know.
So he talks like that. And when I got the suit, these suits were used all over the country and all over the world. It was not
wonderful.
An original idea. In fact, I borrowed one from a bag monster in Seattle.
I was wondering how it was constructed, because every time I've seen pictures of it or seeing you moving in it, it looks like it's not falling apart.
It's not falling apart. But I guess what I'd love to say, I can tell you afterward how it's constructed. We can keep that secret to ourselves. But I think what happened when the counselors all laughed when we were in council chambers.
You were appearing before the Port Townsend Council.
Yeah, we were doing a petition, and I was just promoting the petition process. I could go on and on about all the different people who did all the parts of this. It was kind of like the plantathon in that way. Each person did their own part of it. Jim Todd ran the petition, and Gene Wallet ran the education campaign, and the co-op ran the graphics and publicity, and Environment Washington helped with a lot of the templates. And, of course, the city council did all the nitty-gritty work of actually crafting the
It's an ordinance, the ordinance. That says we won't do this anymore.
So
right?
Really what they had said when we – when Rocky at the Rose, he showed Bagot, and I asked, well, what would we need to do this here? And they said we'd need a huge show of support. So basically I went in to just sort of promote it and gather petitions in the costume, and they all just laughed. And I thought, this is what we need. I could stand up here and I could give them all this data, and I'd be here for years, you know.
Which happens to a lot of proposals. They just language. So.
And in fact, I mean, a lot of people, when they would see me in public gathering petitions, they would walk straight up to me and say, I don't know what you're doing, but where do I sign? It was immediate.
Really useful.
It
right?
was just
That's great.
They just got it.
Well, the Bag Monster has his own beauty, for sure. I know that he's upset about being.
Oh, he's in Tijuana. Don't worry about
him. He's in Tijuana.
He's very, very big.
Was he able to make some money, maybe just a little on the side from being the Bag Monster?
I
thought it was amazing that the Bag Monster could walk at all. But if you see a picture, those of you who are listening, if you see a picture of the Bag Monster is wearing at least 500 bags, about the number that has been noted each of us individually might use if we were using plastic. So you can, it's very easy to bring 5 bags home in a grocery bag without even thinking about
it.
So on with the non-plastics. But what's wonderful is the humor of it, because I think when we started way back with sustainable gardening, the idea was to get people to shift their opinions. And that is not easy to do. Something has to feel real and present to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we could probably do a whole other show on the care and feeding of volunteers and the appreciation of the natural world. But I wanted to add one thing, which is when you do what you're doing and choose to do it, you're working on this tiny little piece of healing.
And it's a very small piece.
It's a very, you're right. It is. It's a very small piece. And there's a sense that it's getting done.
Right. Yeah. I guess I struggled a lot with how small the work seemed. This was just a small fundraiser that we were doing. We were getting maybe 150 people out there, and it was very grassroots. Over time, what I've realized as kids come back from college, kind of report back and say, this was something to me. I realize it's not good to judge yourself and to feel that you're not enough. Kind of never know. Who are you to judge whether it's enough or not, really? That was the
big great
takeaway for me.
Thank you, Jude. So, I'm so glad that we've been able to talk with you today. And
you,
as
Mary.
I said, we could happily ramble on. We have to stop rambling because our time is up. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's that mystery sound again. It's the Oregon Junco, a ground-hugging bird, neatly feathered, with a dark head and lighter markings on the back and belly. They hop rather than walking. Often the lighter feathers appear nearly pink, and the bill often has a pink cast. They peck for seeds and will take millet from a home feeder. Juncos build nests near the ground in low conifer branches or brush piles. When raising fledglings, they catch insects, moths, beetles, wasps, ants, and flies. They're a distinctive and welcome winter bird, arriving here from northern summer areas or usually staying here year-round. Oregon juncos are one race of the dark-eyed juncos found nearly everywhere in North America. Their black hood distinguishes the Oregon junco from other relatives. They are in the sparrow family, definitely better looking than ordinary sparrows.
You may not hear the trilling song that we played for you. It's often delivered by the male when seeking a mate. In spite of all the singing, the females are noted to be as attracted to the white flash of tail feathers as they are to the song. The more white tail feathers, the better. Is this the jungle version of George Clooney in a tuxedo? Could be. And now to events. This is a very bird-ridden show, and that's a good thing. There are 2 field trips from the Audubon Society. Both of them are November 21st, which is this coming Saturday. The first is to Ida's Hook and Port Angeles Harbor, 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 noon. Birders get up early. And the Migrating Waterfall Walk at the Dungeness National Wildlife Refuge, also November 21st, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., and that's the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. They really like to get out, and we get to learn from them. Finally, I wanted to note a book. Some of you probably heard the interview done earlier this year by Nan Evans about the new book called The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. It's by Audrey DeLella Benedict and Joseph K. Gatos. This book, which came out in March 2015, was funded by the Sea Doc Society, the same group that is funding the survey of fish in the Salish Sea. Their motto is, People and Science Healing the Sea, and I sure hope that motto works. In any case, it's a wonderful book. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the third week of November. Thanks very much, Charlie, for reading through this, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and it's available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. And as always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.